spaced letter, a letter of his own agony. The world was still sick, sick to the heart. The war itself, the senseless deaths at home on top of all else, Wilson's betrayal of ideals at Versailles, a betrayal that penetrated the soul, the utter failure of science, the greatest achievement of modern man in the face of the disease. In January 1923, John Dewey wrote in the New Republic, "It may be doubted if the consciousness of sickness was ever so widespread as it is today. The interest in cures and salvations is evidence of how sick the world is." He was speaking of a consciousness that went beyond physical disease, but physical disease was part of it. He was speaking of the world of which F. Scott Fitzgerald declared, "All gods dead, all wars fought, all faiths in man shaken." The disease has survived in memory more than in any literature. Nearly all those who were adults during the pandemic have died now. Now the memory lives in the minds of those who only heard stories, who heard how their mother lost her father, how an uncle became an orphan, or heard an aunt say, "It was the only time I ever saw my father cry." Memory dies with people. The writers of the 1920s had little to say about it. Mary McCarthy got on a train in Seattle on October 30, 1918, with her three brothers and sisters, her aunt and uncle, and her parents. They arrived in Minneapolis 3 days later, all of them sick. Her father had pulled out a gun when the conductor tried to put them off the train, met by her grandparents wearing masks. All the hospitals were full, and so they went home. Her aunt and uncle recovered, but her father, Roy, 38 years old, died on November 6th, and her mother, Tess, 29 years old, died November 7th. In Memories of a Catholic Girlhood, she spoke of how deeply being an orphan affected her, made her desperate to distinguish herself, and she vividly remembered the train ride across two-thirds of the country, but she said almost nothing of the epidemic. John Dos Passos was in his early 20s and seriously ill with influenza, yet barely mentioned the disease in his fiction. Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald said next to nothing of it. William Maxwell, a New Yorker writer and novelist, lost his mother to the disease. Her death sent his father, brother, and him inward. He recalled, "I had to guess what my older brother was thinking. It was not something he cared to share with me. If I hadn't known, I would have thought that he'd had his feelings hurt by something he was too proud to talk about." For himself, "The ideas that kept recurring to me, perhaps because of that pacing the floor with my father, was that I had inadvertently walked through a door that I shouldn't have gone through, and couldn't get back to the place I hadn't meant to leave." Of his father, he said, "His sadness was of the kind that is patient and without hope." For himself, "The death of my mother was a motivating force in 4 books. Catherine Ann Porter was ill enough that her obituary was set in type. She recovered. Her fiancé did not. Years later, her haunting novella of the disease and the time, Pale Horse, Pale Rider, is one of the best and one of the few sources for what life was like during the disease. And she lived through it in Denver, a city that, compared to those in the East, was struck only a glancing blow. But the relative lack of impact it left on literature may not be unusual at all. It may not be that much unlike what happened centuries ago. One scholar of medieval literature says, "While there are a few vivid and terrifying accounts, it's actually striking how little was written on the bubonic plague. Outside of these few very well-known accounts, there is almost nothing in literature about it afterwards." People write about war. They write about the Holocaust. They write about horrors that people inflict on people. Apparently, they forget the horrors that nature inflicts on people, the horrors that make humans least significant. And yet, the pandemic resonated. When the Nazis took control of Germany in 1933, Christopher Isherwood wrote of Berlin, "The whole city lay under an epidemic of discrete infectious fear. I could feel it, like influenza, in my bones. Those historians who have examined epidemics and analyzed how societies have responded to them have generally argued that those with power blamed the poor for their own suffering, and sometimes tried to stigmatize and isolate them. The case of Typhoid Mary Mallon, an Irish immigrant in effect imprisoned for 25 years, is a classic instance of this attitude. If she had been of another class, the treatment of her might well have been different. Those in power, historians have observed, often sought security in imposing order, which gave them some feeling of control, some feeling that the world still made sense. In 1918, what might be considered a power elite did sometimes behave according to such a pattern. Denver Health Commissioner William Sharpley, for example, blamed the city's difficulties with influenza on foreign settlements of the city, chiefly Italians. The Durango Evening Herald blamed the high death toll among Utes on a reservation on their negligence and disobedience to the advice of their superintendent and nurses and physicians. One Red Cross worker in the mining regions of Kentucky took offense at uncleanliness. When we reached the miserable shack, it seemed deserted. I went on in, and there, lying with her legs out of the bed and her head thrown way back on a filthy pillow, was the woman, stone dead, her eyes staring, her mouth yawning, a most gruesome sight. The mother of the woman's husband came in, an old woman living in an indescribable shack some 300 feet away. I can still smell the terrible odor and will never forget the nauseating sight. The penalty for filth is death. Yet, despite such occasional harshness, the 1918 influenza pandemic did not in general demonstrate a pattern of race or class antagonism. In epidemiological terms, there was a correlation between population density and hence class and deaths. But the disease still struck down everyone. And the deaths of soldiers of such promise and youth struck home with everyone. The disease was too universal, too obviously not tied to race or class. In Philadelphia, white and black certainly got comparable treatment. In mining areas around the country, whether out of self-interest or not, mine owners tried to find doctors for their workers. In Alaska, racism notwithstanding, authorities launched a massive rescue effort, if too late, to save Eskimos. Even the very Red Cross worker so nauseated by filth continued to risk his own life day after day in one of the hardest hit areas of the country. During the second wave, many local governments collapsed, and those who held the real power in a community, from Philadelphia's Blue Bloods to Phoenix's Citizens Committee, took over. But generally, they exercised power to protect the entire community rather than to split it, to distribute resources widely rather than to guarantee resources for themselves. Despite that effort, whoever held power, whether a city government or some private gathering of the locals, they generally failed to keep the community together. They failed because they lost trust. They lost trust because they lied. San Francisco was a rare exception. Its leaders told the truth, and the city responded heroically. And they lied for the war effort, for the propaganda machine that Wilson had created. It is impossible to quantify how many deaths the lies caused. It is impossible to quantify how many young men died because the army refused to follow the advice of its own Surgeon General. But while those in authority were reassuring people that this was influenza, only influenza, nothing different from ordinary la grippe, at least some people must have believed them. At least some people must have exposed themselves to the virus in ways they would not have otherwise, and at least some of these people must have died who would otherwise have lived. And fear really did kill people. It killed them because those who feared would not care for many of those who needed but could not find care. Those who needed only hydration, food, and rest to survive. It is also impossible to state with any accuracy the death toll. The statistics are estimates only, and one can only say that the totals are numbing. The few places in the world that then kept reliable vital statistics under normal circumstances could not keep pace with the disease. In the United States, only large cities and 24 states kept accurate enough statistics for the U.S. Public Health Service to include them in their database, the so-called registration area. Even in them, everyone, from physicians to city clerks, was trying to survive or help others survive. Record-keeping had low priority, and even in the aftermath, little effort was made to compile accurate numbers. Many who died never saw a doctor or nurse. Outside the developed world, the situation was far worse, and in the rural regions of India, the Soviet Union, which was engaged in a brutal civil war, China, Africa, and South America, where the disease was often most virulent, good records were all but non-existent. The first significant attempts to quantify the death toll came in 1927. An American Medical Association-sponsored study estimated that 21 million died. When today's media refers to a death toll of more than 20 million in stories on the 1918 pandemic, the source is this study. But every revision of the deaths since 1927 has been upward. The U.S. death toll was originally put at 550,000. Now epidemiologists have settled on 675,000 out of a population of 105 million. In the year 2004, the U.S. population exceeds 291 million. Worldwide, both the estimated toll and the population have gone up by a far greater percentage. In the 1940s, McFarlane Burnett, the Nobel laureate who spent most of his scientific life studying influenza, estimated the death toll at 50 to 100 million. Since then, various studies, with better data and statistical methods, have gradually moved the estimates closer and closer to his. First, several studies concluded that the death toll on the Indian subcontinent alone may have reached 20 million. Other new estimates were presented at a 1998 international conference on the pandemic. And in 2002, an epidemiological study reviewed the data and concluded that the death toll was in the order of 50 million. But even this vast figure may be substantially lower than the real toll. In fact, like Burnett, it suggested that as many as 100 million died. Given the world's population in 1918 of approximately 1.8 billion, the upper estimate would mean that in 2 years, and with most of the deaths coming in a horrendous 12 weeks in the fall of 1918, in excess of 5% of the people in the world died. Today's world population is 6.3 billion. To give a sense of the impact in today's world of the 1918 pandemic, one has to adjust for population. If one uses the lowest estimate of deaths, the 21 million figure, that means a comparable figure today would be 73 million dead. The higher estimates translate into between 175 and 350 million dead. Those numbers are not meant to terrify. Although they do. Medicine has advanced since 1918 and would have considerable impact on the mortality rate. Those numbers are meant simply to communicate what living through the pandemic was like. Yet even those numbers understate the horror of the disease. The age distribution of the deaths brings that horror home. In a normal influenza epidemic, 10% or fewer of the deaths fall among those aged between 16 and 40. In 1918, that age group, the men and women with most vitality, most to live for, most of a future, accounted for more than half the death toll. And within that group, the worst mortality figures fell upon those aged 21 to 30. The Western world suffered the least, not because its medicine was so advanced, but because urbanization had exposed its population to influenza viruses, so immune systems were not naked to it. In the United States, roughly 0.65% of the total population died, with roughly double that percentage of young adults killed. Of developed countries, Italy suffered the worst, losing approximately 1% of its total population. The Soviet Union may have suffered more, but few numbers are available for it. The virus simply ravaged the less developed world. In Mexico, the most conservative estimate of the death toll was 2.3% of the entire population, and other reasonable estimates put the death toll over 4%. That means somewhere between 5 and 9% of all young adults died. And in the entire world, although no one will ever know with certainty, it seems more than just possible that 5%, and in the less developed countries approaching 10% of the world's young adults were killed by the virus. In addition to the dead, in addition to any lingering complications among survivors, in addition to any contribution the virus made to the sense of bewilderment and betrayal and loss and nihilism of the 1920s, the 1918 pandemic left other legacies. Some were good ones. Around the world, authorities made plans for international cooperation on health, and the experience led to restructuring public health efforts throughout the United States. The New Mexico Department of Public Health was created. Philadelphia rewrote its city charter to reorganize its public health department. From Manchester, Connecticut to Memphis, Tennessee and beyond, emergency hospitals were transformed into permanent ones. And the pandemic motivated Louisiana Senator Joe Ransdell to begin pushing for the establishment of the National Institutes of Health, although he did not win his fight until a far milder influenza epidemic in 1928 reminded Congress of the events of a decade earlier. All those things are part of the legacy left by the virus. But the disease left its chief legacy in the laboratory. Part 10. Endgame. Chapter 34. By World War I, the revolution in American medicine led by William Welch had triumphed. That revolution had radically transformed American medicine, forcing its teaching, research, art, and practice through the filter of science. Those in the United States capable of doing good scientific research remained a small, almost a tiny cadre. The group was large enough to be counted in the dozens, and, counting the most junior investigators, by the mid-1920s it reached several dozens, but no more. They all knew each other, all had shared experiences, and nearly all had at least some connection to the Hopkins, the Rockefeller Institute, Harvard, or to a lesser extent the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Michigan, or Columbia. The group was so small that it still included the first generation of revolutionaries, with Welch and Vaughan and Theobald Smith and a few others still active. Then came their first students, men only a few years younger. Gorgas, who had reached mandatory retirement age from the Army days before the war ended. The Army could have allowed him to remain, but he had no friends among Army superiors. And who then shifted to international public health issues for a Rockefeller-funded foundation. Flexner and Park and Cole in New York. Milton Rosenau in Boston. Frederick Novi at Michigan. And Ludwig Hechten in Chicago. Then came the next half-generation of protégés. Lewis in Philadelphia. Avery, Doshea, Thomas Rivers, and others at Rockefeller. George Whipple in Rochester, New York. Eugene Opie at Washington University in St. Louis, and a few dozen more. It was only in the next generation and the next that the numbers of true researchers began to multiply enormously and spread throughout the country. The bonds that held these men together were not of friendship. Some of them, Park and Flexner, for example, had no love for each other, Many had happily embarrassed a rival by finding flaws in his work, and they had no illusions about each other's virtues. The profession had grown large enough for maneuvering within it. If one listened closely, one could hear, the appointment of Dr. Opie as the primary key man in this plan would be a fatal mistake. Or, Jordan seems at first a rather dazzling possibility, but I am a little afraid that he is not a man who can be absolutely certain to stand up for his convictions in a tight place. Or, of the names you suggest, I would distinctly prefer Emerson, but I fear he would be particularly unacceptable to Russell and Cole, and perhaps to the Rockefeller Foundation Group in general, as I have the impression that he has been somewhat at outs with them. Yet these men also recognize that whatever each other's flaws might be, each of them also had strengths, remarkable strengths. Their work was good enough that, even if in error, one could often find in that error something new, something important, something to build upon. It was an exclusive group and, despite rivalries and dislikes, almost a brotherhood. A brotherhood that included a very few women, literally a handful. And in bacteriology, these very few women did not extend far beyond Anna Williams and Martha Wallstein. Florence Sabin was the leading female medical scientist in the United States, the first woman to graduate from the Hopkins Medical School, the first woman full professor at any medical school in the country, at the Hopkins, and the first woman elected to the National Academy of Sciences. Sabin was not a bacteriologist or involved in influenza research, and hence is not a part of this story. All of these scientists had worked frenetically in their laboratories from the first days of the disease, and none of them had stopped. In those most desperate of circumstances, the most desperate circumstances in which they, and arguably any scientist, ever worked, most of them had willingly, hopefully, accepted less evidence than they would normally have to reach a conclusion. For of course, as Miguel de Unamuno said, the more desperate one is, the more one hopes. But for all their frenzy of activity, they had still always avoided chaos. They had always proceeded from well-grounded hypotheses. They had not, as Avery said with contempt, poured material from one test tube into another. They had not done the wild things that had no basis in their understanding of the workings of the body. They had not given quinine or typhoid vaccine to influenza victims in the wild hope that because it worked against malaria or typhoid, it might work against influenza. Others had done these things and more, but they had not. They also recognized their failures. They had lost their illusions. They had entered the first decades of the 20th century confident that science, even if its victories remained limited, would triumph. Now Victor Vaughan told a colleague, "Never again allow me to say that medical science is on the verge of conquering disease." With the contempt one reserves for one's own failings, he also said, "Doctors know no more about this flu than 14th century Florentine doctors had known about the Black Death." But they had not quit. Now this scientific brotherhood was beginning its hunt. It would take longer than they knew. So far, each laboratory had been working in isolation, barely communicating with the others. Investigators had to meet, to trade ideas, to trade laboratory techniques, to discuss findings not yet published or that one investigator thought unimportant that might mean something to another. They had to try to piece together some way to make concrete progress against this pestilence. They had to sift through the detritus of their failures for clues to success. On October 30th, 1918, with the epidemic on the East Coast fading to manageable proportions, Hermann Biggs organized an influenza commission of leading scientists. Biggs had a proud history, having made the New York City Municipal Health Department the best in the world, but, fed up with Tammany politics, had left to become State Commissioner of Public Health. His commission included Cole, Park, Lewis, Rosenau, epidemiologists, and pathologists. Welch, still recovering in Atlantic City, was too ill to attend. Biggs opened the first meeting by echoing Vaughan. There has never been anything which compares with this in importance, in which we were so helpless. But unlike Vaughan, he was angry, declaring their failures a serious reflection upon public health administration and work and medical science that we should be in the situation we now are. They had seen the epidemic coming for months. Yet public health officials and scientists both had done nothing to prepare. We ought to have been able to obtain all the scientific information available now or that can be had 6 months from now before this reached us at all. He was determined that they would now address this problem and solve it. It would not be so easy. And even in that first meeting, the problems presented themselves. They knew virtually nothing about this disease. They could not even agree upon its nature. The pathology was too confusing. The symptoms were too confusing. Even this late, Cole still wondered if it was influenza at all. All who have seen cases in the early stage think we are dealing with a new disease. One great difficulty for us is to find what influenza is and how to make the diagnosis. We have been going over all case histories during this epidemic, and it is almost as difficult to see which is influenza. A very complex picture. A Navy scientist observed, "In several places there has been a similarity of symptoms with the bubonic plague." A Harvard investigator dismissed their observations. "It is the same old disease and does not change a bit in its character." But it did change, changed constantly. From mild cases of influenza, from which victims recovered quickly, to cases with strange symptoms never associated with influenza. From sudden, violent viral pneumonias, or ARDS, to secondary invaders causing bacterial pneumonias. All these conditions were being seen. Luellis Barker, Cole's mentor at the Hopkins, noted, "The pneumonia specimens which came in from different areas are very different. Those from Devens are entirely different from those from Baltimore, and they differ from several other camps. The lesions are quite different in different localities." They reached no consensus about the disease and moved on to discuss the likely pathogen. There, too, they could reach not even a tentative conclusion. Investigators had found Pfeiffer's influenza bacillus, yes. But Cole had reported that Avery had also discovered B. influenzae in 30% of healthy people at the Rockefeller Institute. That proved nothing. It might be commonly found now because of the epidemic and be an unusual finding in non-epidemic times. Besides, as they all knew, many healthy people carried pneumococci in their mouths and did not get pneumonia. And in the lungs of epidemic victims, they had also found pneumococci, streptococci, staphylococci, and other pathogens. Park asked about the chances that a filterable virus caused the disease. Rosenau was conducting experiments pursuing that question. They knew so little. So little. They knew only that isolation worked. The New York State Training School for Girls had quarantined itself, even requiring people delivering supplies to leave them outside. It had had no cases. The Trudeau Sanatorium in upstate New York had similar rules. It had no cases. Across the continent, a naval facility in San Francisco on an island that enforced rigid quarantine. It had no cases. All that proved was that the miasma theory, which none of them believed in anyway, could not account for the disease. Yet they ended with agreement. They agreed on lines of approach, on the work that needed to be done. Only on that, in effect, on how little they knew, they could agree. They intended to proceed down two paths. One, exploring the epidemiology of the disease, the other, tracing clues in the laboratory. The first task in both lines of attack was to cut through the fog of data that was coming in. They planned precise epidemiological investigations, correlating public health measures and deaths, performing extremely detailed studies in selected areas, for example, isolating small communities where they would account for the 72 hours before every single person who suffered from influenza felt the first symptoms, taking detailed personal histories of both victims and those who had not been attacked, looking for linkages with other diseases, with earlier influenza attacks, with diet. The epidemiological studies would have the ancillary benefit of exciting and transforming another emerging field of medicine. In November 1918, the American Public Health Association created a Committee on Statistical Study of the Influenza Epidemic, funded largely by the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. One committee member called this an opportunity to show what statistics, especially vital statistics, and its methods can do for preventive medicine, while a colleague saw it as the possible vindication of the theory of probabilities and the method of random sampling. In January 1919, the Surgeons General of the Army, the Navy, and the Public Health Service also joined with the Census Bureau to form an influenza committee that grew into a permanent statistical office. Yet, at the same time, an epidemiologist present at the first meeting of the Biggs Group said, "I realize the problem has got to be solved ultimately in the laboratory." Gorgas had had one goal: to make this war the first one in American history in which battle killed more troops than disease. Even with one out of every 67 soldiers in the army dying of influenza, and although his superiors largely ignored his advice, he just barely succeeded. Although when Navy casualties and influenza deaths were added to the totals, deaths from disease did exceed combat deaths. Gorgas had largely triumphed over every other disease. U.S. soldiers almost entirely escaped malaria, for example, even while it struck down tens of thousands of French, British, and Italians. Now, 2 million men were returning from Europe. After other wars, even in the late 19th century, returning troops had carried diseases home. British, French, and Russian troops had spread cholera after the Crimean War. American troops had spread typhoid, dysentery, and smallpox after the Civil War. Prussians had brought smallpox home from the Franco-Prussian War, and Americans had returned from the Spanish-American War carrying typhoid. One of Gorgas's last acts was to set in motion plans to prevent any such happenings this time. Soldiers were kept isolated for 7 days before they boarded ships home and were deloused before embarking. Soldiers would be bringing no disease home. Meanwhile, the most massive scientific inquiry ever undertaken was taking shape. Biggs's commission met 3 more times. By the last meeting, every member would be serving on other commissions as well. The American Medical Association, the American Public Health Association, the Army, the Navy, the Public Health Service, the Red Cross, and the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company all launched major studies in addition to those already begun, each of them designed to complement and not overlap with the others. At every meeting of every medical specialty, of every public health organization, in every issue of every medical journal, influenza dominated the agenda. In Europe, it was the same. Every major laboratory in the United States continued to focus on the disease. Lewis in Philadelphia kept after it, as did others at the University of Pennsylvania. Rosenau in Boston led a team of Harvard researchers. Ludwig Hechten and Preston Kies at the University of Chicago stayed after it. E.C. Rosenau at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota continued to work on it. Every member of the Army's Pneumonia Commission returned to civilian research and continued to investigate influenza. The Metropolitan Life Insurance Company gave grants to university scientists and actually subsidized both the City of New York and the federal government, giving grants for research by Park and Williams in their New York laboratories and by George McCoy of the Public Health Service's Hygienic Laboratory. The Army also made every effort to collect specimens representing pulmonary lesions due to the present influenza epidemic, not only from Army camps, but from civilian sources. These specimens would prove enormously important more than 3/4 of a century later, when Jeffrey Taubenberger would extract the 1918 influenza virus from them and successfully sequence its genome. At the Rockefeller Institute, Cole put every available man to work on it. He also put Martha Wallstein on it. When Captain Francis Blake, who had been part of the Army's Pneumonia Commission, visited his old colleagues at the Institute at Christmas, he found everyone working tooth and nail on this influenza business with monkeys and everything else. A week later, out of the Army and back at Rockefeller, he said, "I shall be so glad when we can get all this business off our hands and finished up, and I can do something else for a change, as it seems as though I have done nothing but work on, and eat, and dream about, and live with pneumonia and influenza for 6 months." He would not be free of it any time soon. Slowly, over a period of months, a body of knowledge began to form. Investigators began to learn about the firestorm that had roared around the world and was continuing to smolder. First, they confirmed what they had suspected. The lethal fall disease was a second wave of the same disease that had hit in the spring. They based their conclusion on the fact that those exposed to the spring wave had substantial immunity to the later one. The Army had the best records. These records involved chiefly young men, so they were not useful in answering some questions. But they could speak to immunity, and clearly demonstrated it. Camp Shelby, for example, was home to the only division in the United States that remained in the United States from March through the fall. In April 1918, influenza sickened 2,000 of 26,000 troops there enough to seek treatment. Many more probably had lesser or subclinical infections, and all 26,000 men were exposed to the disease. During the summer, 11,645 new recruits arrived. In October, influenza scarcely touched the old troops, but decimated the recruits. In Europe in the spring, influenza hit the 11th Regiment Engineers, making 613 men out of a command of 1,200 ill and killing two, but protecting them from the lethal wave. In the fall, the regiment suffered only 150 colds and a single death. Camp Dodge had two units of seasoned troops. Influenza had struck one group in the spring, and only 6.6% of this organization caught influenza in the fall. The other group escaped the spring wave, but 48.5% of them had influenza in the fall. And there were many other examples. Statistics also confirmed what every physician, indeed every person, already knew. In the civilian population as well, young adults had died at extraordinary and frightening rates. The elderly, normally the group most susceptible to influenza, not only survived attacks of the disease, but were attacked far less often. This resistance of the elderly was a worldwide phenomenon. The most likely explanation is that an earlier pandemic, later analysis of antibodies proved it was not the 1889-91, so mild as to not attract attention, resembled the 1918 virus closely enough that it provided protection. Finally, a door-to-door survey in several cities also confirmed the obvious. People living in the most crowded conditions suffered more than those with the most space. It also seemed, although this was not scientifically established, that those who went to bed the earliest, stayed there the longest, and had the best care, also survived at the highest rates. Those findings meant, of course, that the poor died in larger numbers than the rich. Questions about race and the epidemic yielded contradictory information. But nearly everything else about the disease remained unsettled. Even the interplay between the germ theory of disease and other factors was at issue. As late as 1926, a respected epidemiologist still argued a version of the miasma theory, claiming a correlation between influenza and cyclic variation in air pressure. In the laboratory, however, the fog remained dense. The pathogen remained unknown. Enormous resources were being poured into this research everywhere. In Australia, McFarlane Burnett lived through the epidemic as a teenager, and it burned itself into his consciousness. As he said soon after receiving the Nobel Prize, For me, as for many others interested in bacteriology and infectious disease, the outstanding objective in medicine for years was influenza. Yet all this work had not penetrated the fog. The problem did not lie in any lack of clues. The problem lay in distinguishing the few clues that led in the right direction from all those that led in the wrong direction. This was not bubonic plague. That was among the easiest pathogens to discover. The bacteria that caused it swarmed in the buboes. This was only influenza. As the second wave of influenza had broken upon the world, thousands of scientists had attacked the problem. In Germany and France, they had attacked it. In Britain and Italy. In Australia and Brazil. In Japan and China. But as 1919 wore away, then 1920, as the disease drifted toward mildness, one at a time, these thousands began to peel off. They found the problem too difficult to conceptualize, to figure out a way to address it, or the techniques seemed too inadequate to address it, or it lay too far from their old interests or knowledge base. After 2 years of extraordinary and continuing efforts by many of the world's best investigators, in 1920, Welch made a frustrating prediction. "I think that this epidemic is likely to pass away, and we are no more familiar with the control of the disease than we were in the epidemic of 1889. It is humiliating, but true." Hundreds of investigators did continue to pursue the question, but they could agree on little. Everything was in dispute. And central to those disputes were the old team of William Park and Anna Williams on one side, Paul Lewis, and many of those at the Rockefeller Institute on another. Lewis's research would end in irony and tragedy. The Rockefeller Institute would discover most of its own investigators in error. But Oswald Avery would not be in error. Avery would make the most profound discovery of them all. Chapter 35. The greatest questions remained the simplest ones. What caused influenza? What was the pathogen? Was Pfeiffer right when he identified a cause and named it Bacillus influenzae? And if he was not right, then what did cause it? What was the killer? The pursuit of this question is a classic case of how one does science, of how one finds an answer, of the complexity of nature, of how one builds a solid scientific structure. All through the epidemic, bacteriologists had had mixed results looking for B. influenzae. People as skilled as Park and Williams in New York, Lewis in Philadelphia, and Avery had all been unable to isolate it from the first cases they studied. Then they adjusted their techniques, changed the medium in which they grew it, added blood heated to a particular temperature to the medium, changed the dyes used for staining, and they found it. Park and Williams soon found it so consistently that Park assured the National Research Council it was the etiological agent, the cause of the disease. The Public Health Service believed it to be the cause. Lewis, despite initial misgivings, thought it the cause. At Rockefeller, Martha Wallstein had studied Pfeiffer's bacillus since 1906. After several years of work, she still had not considered her experiments sufficiently clean-cut and stable to signify Pfeiffer's is the specific inciting agent. But she had continued to study the bacillus, and in the midst of the pandemic, she had become convinced B. influenzae did cause the disease. She had been so confident that the vaccine she prepared included only Pfeiffer's bacillus. Her work convinced her Rockefeller colleagues as well. They all took her vaccine, even though they were among the few in the country with access to the Rockefeller antipneumococcus vaccine, which had proven itself effective. Midway through the pandemic, failure to find Pfeiffer's seemed a mark not of good science but of incompetence. When one army bacteriologist failed to find it on blood agar plates from 159 of the first patients, the army sent another scientist to the camp to undertake an investigation of the bacteriologic methods employed in the laboratory of the base hospital. Typical of the institution Gorgas had built, it was a true investigation, not a witch hunt, and it concluded that this particular laboratory had done a splendid piece of work. If the influenza bacillus had been present, it would have been found. But that conclusion did not come out until long after the epidemic had passed. In the meantime, the existence of such an investigation told other army bacteriologists that inability to find B. influenzae meant they did not know their job. Simultaneously, Avery published the new techniques he had developed that made it much easier to grow the organism. Bacteriologists began to find what they were looking for. At Camp Zachary Taylor, bacteriologists had been unable to find Pfeiffer's bacillus. Now they reported, more laterally, Avery's oleate medium was used with very gratifying results. They found the bacteria everywhere. In 48.7% of samples of blood taken directly from the heart. In 54.8% of lungs. In 48.3% of spleens. At Camp Dix, in every case studied, the influenza bacillus was found either in the lungs or in the upper respiratory tract or nasal sinuses. In camp after camp, bacteriologists fell into line. Bacteriologists at Camp MacArthur in Texas were not alone in their determination to obtain the highest possible incidence of B. influenzae, and they found it in 88% of lungs. But they did so not through any irrefutable laboratory tests. They simply looked through a microscope and identified the bacteria by appearance. Such observations are subjective and not proof. Only indications. At Camp Sherman, where the mortality rate had been the highest in the country and the reputations of camp doctors had been called into question, the final report on the epidemic exemplified the tension. In a section written by the bacteriologist, the report said, "The persistent absence of influenza bacilli in the diverse materials examined militated against attributing the epidemic to the Pfeiffer organism." But the section written by the pathologist, in effect, accused the bacteriologist of incompetence. The pathologist said he had observed pathogens through the microscope that he believed were Pfeiffer's organism, and that all the bacteria which were present in this epidemic were not discovered as a result of the cultural methods used. Civilian investigators isolated Pfeiffer's with similar regularity. Yet even with all the findings of Pfeiffer's B. influenzae, the picture remained confusing. For rarely, even though Avery's medium inhibited the growth of pneumococci and hemolytic streptococci, both of which had often been found in influenza cases, was Pfeiffer's found alone. And sometimes B. influenzae was still not being found at all. Investigators were especially failing to find it in the lungs of victims who died quickly. In at least three camps, Fremont in California and Gordon and Wheeler in Georgia, the failure to find Pfeiffer's in an overwhelming majority of cases simply meant that the bacteriologists, instead of exposing themselves to possible criticism, diagnosed victims of the epidemic as suffering from other respiratory diseases instead of influenza. In some cases, even the most experienced investigators found the bacillus rarely. In Chicago, D.J. Davis had studied Pfeiffer's for 10 years, but found it in only 5 of 62 cases. In Germany, where Pfeiffer himself remained one of the most powerful figures in medical science, some researchers could not isolate the bacillus either, although he continued to insist it caused the disease. These reports created increasing doubt about the Pfeiffer's influenza bacillus. Scientists did not doubt the word of those who found it. They did not doubt that the bacillus could cause disease and kill, but they began to doubt what finding it proved. There were other questions. In the midst of the epidemic, under the greatest pressures, many bacteriologists had compromised the quality of their work in the hope of getting quick results. As one scientist said, it requires at least 3 weeks of concentrated labor to investigate and identify the various species of streptococci from a single drop of normal sputum smeared on one plate of our culture medium. How then is it possible for two workers to investigate the bacteriology of the respiratory tract of, say, 100 cases of influenza and of 50 normal individuals in 1 year, except in the most slipshod manner? Park and Williams were anything but slipshod. They had been among the first to proclaim B. influenzae the likely cause of the epidemic. In mid-October, Park still held to that position, declaring, "The influenza bacilli have been found in nearly every case of clear-cut infectious influenza. In the complicating pneumonias, they have been found associated with either the hemolytic streptococcus or pneumococci. In one case, the bronchopneumonia was due entirely to the influenza bacillus. The results of the Department of Health of the City of New York have closely agreed with those reported from Chelsea Naval Hospital." They had prepared and distributed a vaccine based largely upon their conviction. But even Park and Williams had made compromises. Now, as the epidemic waned, they continued their investigations with great deliberateness. They had always been best at testing hypotheses, looking for flaws, improving upon and expanding others' more original work. Now, chiefly to learn more about the organism in the hope of perfecting a vaccine and serum, but also to test their own hypothesis that B. influenzae caused influenza, they started an extensive series of experiments. They isolated the bacillus from 100 cases and succeeded in growing 20 pure cultures of it. They then injected these cultures into rabbits, waited long enough for the rabbits to develop an immune response, then drew the rabbit's blood, centrifuged out the solids, and followed the other steps to prepare serum. When the serum from each rabbit was added in test tubes to the bacteria used to infect that rabbit, the antibodies in the serum agglutinated the bacteria. The antibodies bound to the bacteria and formed visible clumps. They had expected that result, but not their next ones. When they tested these different sera against other cultures of fifers, agglutination occurred only 4 of 20 times. The serum did not bind to the fifers in the other 16 cultures. Nothing happened. They repeated the experiments and got the same results. All the bacterial cultures were definitely fifers bacillus, definitely B. influenzae. There was no mistake in that. All 20 of their sera would bind to and agglutinate bacteria from the same culture used to infect that particular rabbit. But only 4 of the 20 different sera would bind to any bacteria from another culture of fifers. For a decade, scientists had tried to make vaccine and antiserum for fifers influenza bacillus. Flexner himself had tried soon after Lewis left the institute. No one had succeeded. Park and Williams believed they now understood why. They thought fifers resembled the pneumococcus. There were dozens of strains of pneumococci. Types 1, 2, and 3 were common enough that a vaccine and serum had been made that could protect somewhat against all three, though with truly good effect only against types 1 and 2. So-called type 4 wasn't a type at all. It was a grab bag designation of other pneumococci. As they explored fifers further, they became more and more convinced that B. influenzae similarly included dozens of strains, each different enough that an immune serum that worked against one would not work against the others. In fact, Williams found 10 different strains in 10 different cases. In early 1919, Park and Williams reversed their position. They stated, "This evidence of multiple strains seems to be absolutely against the influenza bacillus being the cause of the pandemic. It appears to us impossible that we should miss the epidemic strain in so many cases while obtaining some other strain so abundantly. The influenza bacilli, like the streptococci and pneumococci, are in all probability merely very important secondary invaders." The influenza bacillus, they now said, did not cause influenza. Anna Williams wrote in her diary, "More and more, evidence points to a filterable virus being the cause." Many others were also beginning to think that a filterable virus caused the disease. William McCallum at the Hopkins wrote, "In Camp Lee, we found practically no influenza bacilli. At the Hopkins Hospital, influenza bacilli was rarely found. Since a great many different bacteria have been found producing pneumonia, often in complex mixtures, it would require very special evidence to prove that one of these is the universal cause of the primary disease. And since this particular organism is by no means always present, it seems that the evidence is very weak. Indeed, it appears probable that some other form of living virus, not recognizable by our microscopic methods of staining, and not to be isolated or cultivated by methods currently in use, must be the cause of the epidemic. But the subject remained controversial. No evidence pointed toward a filterable virus except negative evidence, the absence of proof of anything else. And the theory that a virus caused influenza had already been tested by excellent scientists. During the very first outbreak of the second wave in the United States, Rosenau had suspected a filterable virus. Indeed, he had suspected it at least since 1916. His instincts led him to conduct extensive and careful experiments with 62 human volunteers from the Navy brig in Boston. He collected sputum and blood from living victims and emulsified lung tissue of the dead, diluted the samples in a saline solution, centrifuged them, drained off the fluid, and passed them through a porcelain filter, then tried various methods to communicate the disease to the volunteers. He used every imaginable method of injection, inhalation, dripping into nasal and throat passages, even into the eyes, using massive, life-risking dosages. None of the volunteers got sick. One of the physicians conducting the experiments died. In Germany, a scientist had also tried, spraying the throats of volunteers with filtered nasal secretions, but none of the subjects got influenza. In Chicago, a team of investigators failed to infect human volunteers with filtered secretions of influenza victims. Navy investigators in San Francisco failed. Only one researcher in the world was reporting success in transmitting the disease with a filtrate: Charles Nicolle of the Pasteur Institute. But Nicolle's entire series of experiments involved fewer than a dozen people and monkeys. He tried four separate methods of transmitting the disease and claimed success for three of them. First, he dripped filtrate into the nasal passages of monkeys and reported they got influenza. This was possible, although monkeys almost never get human influenza. He injected a filtrate into the mucosal membranes around the eyes of monkeys and reported they got influenza. This was theoretically possible, but even less likely. He also claimed to have given two human volunteers influenza by filtering the blood from an ill monkey and injecting the filtrate subcutaneously, under the men's skin. Both of the men may have gotten influenza. Neither of them could have gotten it by the method Nicolle claimed. Nicolle was brilliant. In 1928, he won the Nobel Prize. But these experiments were wrong. So, lacking other candidates, many scientists remained convinced Pfeiffer's did cause the disease, including most of those at the Rockefeller Institute. So did Eugene Opie, Welch's first star pupil at the Hopkins, who had gone to Washington University in St. Louis to model it after the Hopkins, and had led the laboratory work of the Army's Pneumonia Commission. In 1922, he and several other commission members published their results in a book called Epidemic Respiratory Disease. One co-author was Thomas Rivers, who by then had already begun working on viruses. In 1926, he defined the difference between viruses and bacteria, creating the field of virology and becoming one of the world's leading virologists. But he spent his first 5 years after the war continuing to research Pfeiffer's, writing many papers on it even while beginning his viral researches. He recalled, "We managed to get influenza bacilli out of every person that had an attack of influenza. We found it and quickly jumped to the conclusion that the influenza bacillus was the cause of the pandemic." What it came down to was that nearly all investigators believed their own work. If they had found the influenza bacillus in abundance, they believed it caused influenza. If they had not found it, they believed it did not cause influenza. Only a very few saw beyond their own work and were willing to contradict themselves. Park and Williams were among these few. In doing so, they demonstrated an extraordinary openness, an extraordinary willingness to look with a fresh eye at their own experimental results. Park and Williams had convinced themselves, and many others, that the influenza bacillus did not cause influenza. Then they moved on. They stopped working on influenza, partly out of conviction, partly because the New York City Municipal Laboratory was losing the funding to do true research. And they were getting old now. Through the 1920s, investigators continued to work on the problem. It was, as Burnett said, the single most important question in medical science for years. In England, Alexander Fleming had, like Avery, concentrated on developing a medium in which the bacillus could flourish. In 1928, he left a petri dish uncovered with Staphylococcus growing in it. 2 days later, he discovered a mold that inhibited the growth. He extracted from the mold the substance that stopped the bacteria and called it penicillin. Fleming found that penicillin killed Staphylococcus, hemolytic streptococcus, pneumococcus, gonococcus, diphtheria bacilli, and other bacteria, but it did no harm to the influenza bacillus. He did not try to develop penicillin into a medicine. To him, the influenza bacillus was important enough that he used penicillin to help grow it by killing any contaminating bacteria in the culture. He used penicillin, as he said, for the isolation of influenza bacilli. This special selective cultural technique allowed him to find B. influenzae in the gums, nasal space, and tonsils from practically every individual he investigated. Fleming never did see penicillin as an antibiotic. A decade later, Howard Florey and Ernst